Miss Pickford, in Canada, we've always taken delight in the fact that America's sweetheart was a Canadian. Now, just where did you come from?
I was born in Toronto, Canada. And so was my father and my mother.
Whereabouts in Toronto?
On University Avenue.
Have you seen it lately?
No, it's torn down now.
Because University Avenue is a big, wide thoroughfare of office blocks and hospitals and things.
Do you want me to tell you how I feel about it?
Please do.
Oh, I'm very sad about my old Toronto.
Yes?
Mm-hmm. You know, I used to ride down on my bicycle right from Yonge Street down to Queen.
Yes.
And I didn't have to pedal at all. You know, there's quite a little hill there.
Yes, you wouldn't notice it today. Of course, nobody ever rides a bicycle down University Avenue.
Well, I did, you know. When I went back, even after that the trees had been taken down on the bicycle path, I told the newspaper people how I love my bicycle. And when I was photographed in front of the house where I was born, there stood a bicycle.
What was Toronto like in those days? I suppose it was quite quiet and provincial.
Well, we used to have, you know, horses, naturally. And I still bear a scar that on coming down University Avenue and turning west, I think, on Queen, I got right in front of a pair of horses. And I had to put the brakes on the best I knew how. And I gouged my ankle, and I still have the mark there.
Oh.
But I like it, you know.
What, the mark?
Yes.
Oh, it gives you something to reminisce.
Oh, yes. And you know, I think at least once a month I dream that I'm back again in Toronto. Up in Queen's Park, High Park.
Mm-hmm.
Up north on Yonge Street.
Tell me, what kind of a family was yours? What did your father do, and how many Pickfords were there?
Well, you see, my father's name was Smith.
Oh, Smith.
Mm-hmm. John Charles Smith. And I get the name of Pickford from my mother's people. My father's people were born in England and came up the St. Lawrence River. Grandma Smith went to Toronto when she was 6 years of age and attended the Methodist church, the same church, for 80 years.
That's quite a record, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
80 years.
And when she was 86, she retired and died at the age of 91. And my grandfather, Joseph Smith, also was born in Liverpool, I think. Grandma came from London. And my mother's people were Irish. They came from Tralee, County Kerry.
That's where the rose came from, isn't it?
We're the black Irish, you know, the dangerous kind. You look like a black Irishman yourself.
I'm a black Welshman.
Oh, sure you are.
Tell me, how many brothers and sisters did you have?
I had one brother, Jack. When I loved him very much, I called him Johnny. When I didn't like him so well, I called him Jack.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a sister, Lottie. They were both younger than I. And my mother and father were also born in Toronto. So you see, I'm a real Torontonian.
Now, where did the interest in the theatrical life come into being as far as you're concerned?
Well, it was a matter of economics. None of my family on either side ever were in the theater. In fact, they disapproved of it heartily. Grandma, being a very strict Methodist, of course, didn't believe in the theater or dancing or anything like that. But when my father died, I was 4 years of age, and Mother was left with the three of us and her paralyzed mother, so she had five mouths to feed. And when my father died, they had used up all of their savings for doctors and even sent to the States, as we called it. You still call it the States and
you do?
Yes. Well, so we came to the States after my father died, but that, I'm going ahead of myself. When father died, mother had nothing but her furniture. And so, after a very sad time where we were all dispersed, my brother was in one house, my sister in another, and I in another. I don't know where my poor old grandma was, because mother, well, she was so terribly upset about my father's death. She wanted nothing to do with anyone she'd ever known until my brother Jack became ill. And they said to her, "Do you know Lottie?" That was my mama's name. that little Johnny is very ill and needs you. And that did more than all the doctors and all the medicine for my mother. She realized then she had no time for sorrow. And so we were reunited. And mother sewed very well. She was reared a Catholic in a convent. That was a day. She didn't remain in the convent. She went there during the day, and they taught her to sew. So she became a seamstress and made dresses for the people of the neighborhood and rented out our master bedroom, and never to anyone but to a woman. And one day, a man came to the door and said he wanted to rent our bedroom. And mother said, "Oh, no, I've never rented it to a man." He said, "Well, I'm a married man. I'm sure you'd like my wife. May I bring her to see you?" Mother said, "I'd be delighted to meet her." And with the result that they took the bedroom. Well, he happened to be the manager, the stage manager, of a company then called, the Valentine Stock Company. And he said, "Mrs. Smith, we're putting on a play next week that requires children. Would you allow your three babies to appear in the schoolroom scene?" Mother said, "Gracious, no. I wouldn't allow my children to meet actresses while they smoke." Mother, he said, "Well, some of them do smoke, but not all of them, Mrs. Smith." And he said, I assure you that the ladies and gentlemen of this company are just as nice as any of your friends. He said, "As a matter of fact, they've been together many years. It's like a family." He said, "Come down with me tonight backstage, and if you find anything that is unpleasant or anything that you wouldn't like," he said, "then I agree with you." So Mother went to the theater that night, and of course they were charming and nice people. You know, in our profession, they're good, bad, and indifferent, but these people happen to be very nice. So Mother agreed, with the result that I became a member of that company.
How old were you then?
Five years of age. Lottie was a year younger, and Johnny 2 years and a half younger than I.
That's a very early start in the acting profession.
Oh, there's some that have been carried on the stage, you know. I remember it as though it were yesterday, and I just loved it. You see, I don't know where I got this ham blood in me. Certainly, it must date. Yes, I do know. John Pickford Hennessy, that's where I got it from. He was the only one in my ancestry, as far as I know, that loved the theater. You see, that's where I got my name of Pickford. His mother's name was Elizabeth Pickford, and she was born in England. So, you see, I'm predominantly English.
Well, now, were you on the stage at the age of five?
Yes, forever after.
But what about schooling? What do you do school in the day and work at night?
No, I, as a matter of fact, I think I only went to school about 3 months.
Only 3 months schooling?
Well, my mother taught me, and I am self-taught. I got the best books I could find, and I have a very good ear and a splendid memory, I'm grateful to say. And you know that they say I speak a fairly good French.
Mm-hmm.
I learned that too, but I was taught that. But mother was, as I said, convent bred and had a splendid education. And I worked from the time I was five until today. I'm still working.
When did you feel that you had really arrived in the theater? At what age were you established?
Well, not actually until I had had 3 or 4 years in motion pictures. And as a little girl, I was playing in these dreadful melodramas. Do you want to hear some of the names of them?
Please.
Well, The Fatal Wedding, Wedded But No Wife, The Child Wife. I wasn't the bride, however. In Convict Stripes. Oh, there were some worse names than that. Lottie the Sewing Machine Girl. I didn't happen to be appear in that. But, you know, these were rip-roaring melodramas.
These were early silent motion pictures.
No, they were...
stage plays.
Stage plays.
Oh, all in New York, I suppose.
Oh, no, gracious, no. We were on the road. My poor little mother, she was my size, about 5 feet, you know. Mm. And she had traveled for 19 weeks of one-night stands.
Did your mother ever reconcile herself to the fact that you were in the theatrical profession, which she seemed to dislike so much?
Oh, I think she got over it, yes. She even appeared on the stage herself.
Did she?
Yes. And it was very good, too. My mother could mimic any accent. She was much a better actress than I ever thought of being.
Well, of course, only you can say that. We wouldn't know.
Yeah, no, mother had real talent. And the night that she appeared in the fatal wedding, and you see, she told a fib. And that was the unforgivable thing in our family, for anybody to tell a fib. And she said she'd had experience. So we were sure that God would reach down out of heaven and grab my mother up. So the three of us knelt down and prayed that they wouldn't find out.
And they didn't?
No.
Well, I won't tell anybody.
Don't you tell them. No, I'd send Lottie or Jack, or I'd go myself to find out how Mother was doing. If she would forget her lines, you know, it would be a terrible thing to do. But she didn't, and nobody found out that she had told the fib.
Well, Miss Pickford, when did you first become associated with motion picture work?
Well, I was 15 years of age, and we needed money, as usual. And Mother, to my great unhappiness and, I would say, almost annoyance, because, you know, my mother was a goddess to me. Her word was law. And when she said to me, Gladys, of course, that's, you know, I was baptized Gladys Marie, and she said, Gladys, what about trying those motion picture studios? I said, oh, Mama, not that. Well, she said, it's better that than to be separated this summer. So very reluctantly and maybe belligerently, I went into the Biograph Company, hoping that they wouldn't see me enter, because it was a disgrace, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, definitely.
Tell me, where were the picture studios in those days?
Well, the majority of them were in New York. One was in Brooklyn. The Vitagraph Company was in Brooklyn. Then there was a Lubin Company, Edison, Tannhauser, Biograph, and what is the name? Rubin? There was a company in Philadelphia. And there was another in Chicago. That was Bronco Billy's company. They were there. Nobody was out here at that time in California. And you know that the exteriors were very important. They aren't anymore. Because they take these process shots, you know. I could be walking through the Sahara Desert and stay right here in this room. So they shoot the desert first, and then they put the live figure in front of it.
Mm.
But then it was very important. And I might add, and I hope the Chamber of Commerce of Los Angeles don't hear me, but we had no smog in those days.
The smog came after.
No, it came later.
You were saying that you entered the motion pictures almost with a chip on your shoulder. Well, how did you first get your work?
Well, as I entered the Biograph studio, and it was a big old mansion with a beautiful winding staircase, a circular staircase, marble floor, and out of the opposite door, a swinging door that led to the studio proper, which was a ballroom, came the one and only D.W. Griffith, David Wark Griffith. And he looked me up and down, and I resented it very much. I thought, here's one of these awful people that work in motion pictures. And he said to me, what do you want? I said, I'm looking for work. He said, what experience have you had? Well, this was adding insult to injury. I said, only 10 years. He said, you don't look that old. Well, I said, I am. I'm 15 years old. Well, he said, what did you do last? I said, I just came from the David Belasco Company. He said, that's good enough. Come with me. So he put on my makeup, the first motion picture makeup I ever had, and I want to tell you, I looked more like Pancho Villa. I did. He put enormous black eyebrows on me. And in those days, we used to wear chalk-white makeup. And our eyes and our mouths were greatly exaggerated. Of course, we had no sound, so pantomime was the order of the day. And naturally, when one waves the eyebrows, that's very important, you know, in an emotional scene. But I would never do that. Mr. Griffith used to argue with me, and I said, no, sir. It's not natural, and I won't do it. And he, I since have wondered why he put up with a naughty little girl like I was. But he did.
Well, you got your start then through the great D.W. Griffith.
I was trained by him, and I'm so very, very grateful to him.
Well, he appears to be the major legend of Hollywood, the greatest man in pictures. Why? What was his quality?
Well, he had tremendous imagination. In those days, they didn't have what they call a cutback. For instance, showing you downtown in Los Angeles and showing me up here at Pick Fair, they didn't have that switchback, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think the first close-up was made of me in a picture called Friends with Henry Walthall and Lionel Barrymore. And many mechanical things like irising down or irising in, you know, or fade out. All these things came from D.W. Griffith. He was a bad actor himself.
Well, do you feel that most producers are frustrated actors?
Oh, definitely. I would think so. He had a beautiful, sonorous voice, and he could have been a singer. But when he started to act, he used to frighten me because, you know, he exaggerated things so. And the Pathé Company, the French actors, were greatly admired by us. I mean, all of the Americans.
Yes.
And he used to try to make me do things like that, and I just wouldn't. I said, no, I think if I feel it enough, this is my mother's training. She said, if you feel something very, very much, your hands, your feet, every part of your being will respond to that thought.
What do you think was your first really great motion picture?
Well, let me see. Do you mean in the very, very old days?
Yes, the one which I think would establish you as America's sweetheart.
You're very nice. You know, I've never accepted that title. It's too complimentary. I've never thought that. But I do appreciate it. Well, I would say that Tess of the Storm Country.
Now that was, wasn't that about the beginning of the First World War?
Before
then?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I'm getting to the age now where I'm very proud of the stripes on my arm.
Service stripes.
Yes. It was in 1914 that Pop Grauman, he was the father of the fabulous Sid Grauman, you know, Million Dollar
yes,
Theater,
yes.
Chinese Grauman, he put the name outside, and it didn't take... Well, it took many years for it to catch on. But that was given to me in love, and I'm so pleased about that. If it had been dreamed up by a press agent, I wouldn't have liked it. But this came from the heart of someone who was really fond of me.
What was it like making pictures in those days? From what I've seen today, it looks like extremely exacting, hard work. In those days, was it fun, or was it just as difficult?
Everything's fun when you're young.
And everybody felt that way then, did they?
Oh, I think so.
What was the spirit and the atmosphere of the silent picture?
Well, it was exciting, and we were pioneers in a brand new medium of art. And, well, as I say, when you look back and think on your childhood, everything, well, I don't know about that either. I think that sorrow can be very great to the very young. But I was terribly ambitious. You see, I was the father of the family. And I wanted security for my people. And I didn't know anything but work. I never went anywhere. I didn't buy clothes. I had no jewelry or... Oh, my first extravagance was a car.
Yes.
And I loved my car. It was called EMF. And Johnny Pickford said, even Mama fell. And every morning, fix it. You could just know what kind of a brother I had.
Sounds like a typical brother.
And you know, years before that, I said, oh, I'm not worried about being poor. One day I'm going to have a beautiful automobile. So when I'd come home from work, from the Biograph, Johnny would say to my sister Lottie, look out of the window and see if Mary has tied the Stanley steamer to the hydrant. And Lottie, get out of the front seat. I want to sit there myself. So they'd bring up chairs and pretend they were in the Stanley steamer. One day, my cousin, one of the Irish side, we were on 42nd Street and Broadway. And I was appearing with Cecil B. DeMille at the time, The Warrens of Virginia. And this birdcage, glass birdcage, went by and splashed mud all over my cousin's one and only Sunday dress. You know, for years I used to say my Sunday dress. Mm-hmm. You know, that was my best dress. And she said, now look at those old hens. She said, we're younger and prettier than they are, and they splashed me with mud. I said, never mind, Mamie. I said, we were going to have a beautiful car one day. We're going to come by the street, and maybe we'll splash somebody. Oh, she said, pardon me, Mrs. Astorbilt, but your tiara has slipped. And then years after, we did go by, and she said, Mary, do you remember that day?
Yeah.
I said, what day? And then she repeated the story. I said, I knew it. We were in a beautiful Cadillac. So you see that I had the feeling, you know, that I would have all these things. But, of course, it was a goal, and I believe we always have to have a goal, no matter what it is. But, of course, the material things now don't mean so much to me.
Well, in reviewing your career, may we assume that the 20s were the greatest era in your career?
Yes, I would say so.
This is when they were making really fine pictures, and the end of the silent era.
Well, I'd say anywhere from 1914 on up to about 1930.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, when did you first meet Charlie Chaplin?
I met him in 1912. And I didn't realize what a great genius he was at the time. I remember seeing him at the old Levy's Cafe. Do you know anything about that?
No.
It still exists. And my companion said, there's Chaplin. And I turned around. I expected to see a middle-aged man, of course I was very young. And here was this black-haired man that looked like more like a violinist. And delicate hands and sensitive face. And the waiter came along and opened a transom and let a lot of dust down on his head and into the soup. And the waiter was very apologetic and said, well, sir, I could tell from the pantomime, may I get you another bowl of soup? And Charlie just waved it away. He said, no. That was the first time I ever saw him. And then one time later, there was a big ball given at Long Beach. And he and a man called Pathé Lerman was a Biograph actor. He had been. I was out of it then. I was with famous players, Paramount, you know, that became Paramount later. And Charlie Chaplin took off his shoes and was imitating J. Warren Kerrigan. Did you ever hear of him?
No.
You didn't?
No.
Well, he was the Clark Gable of the day, or the Brando, or any track. He was one of the great stars. And I thought it was very undignified. Now I think it's funny, but I didn't think so then. And Pathé Lerman introduced Chaplin to me, and he gave me what my mother used to call a cold fish hand, you know,
yes,
sort of limp and kind of cold. But I was completely disgusted with his behavior. It wasn't naughty. It was very funny. They were imitating this very handsome. Charlie was playing my part, you see, and Lerman was Kerrigan. And that was my first meeting with Chaplin.
Well, what do you feel about Charlie Chaplin today?
Well, that's quite a question. I think he was, rather, the greatest comedian that the world has ever known.
Mm-hmm.
I think he changed the mask of comedy. He put a mustache on it. I think it's too bad that he destroyed the little man with the big feet.
The little tramp.
That's right.
You think he became too grandiose?
No, I think he got tired of the little man and then tried to be a statesman or a politician or something that doesn't... I think he descended. I think he should never have played Hitler, for instance. He could have gone on till he was 90 years of age playing the little tramp. He personified everything that is, well, miserable. All over the world, he was a poor little human being, but had the philosophy to overcome all of the things that attacked him. And then when he became Hitler and the murderer and Monsieur Verdun, and the last one I haven't seen, the
King in New York.
No, and I don't intend
Limelight,
to.
Limelight?
Limelight I was sad about. I didn't want to see Charlie as an old man. And I regret it very much. And as I said to you the other day, in destroying that little tramp, it's quite possible that the little tramp in turn will destroy Chaplin.
How about Charlie as a person? Is he embittered, mad at the world?
Well, you see, I haven't seen Charlie in 8 years. But I think he's terribly hurt from what I hear. Of course, he has a lovely wife. He has 6, 8 beautiful children.
He certainly has made a contribution to the world in several ways.
And I'm sure that they're going to be talented babies. Of course, Charlie Jr. I love. I don't know much about Sidney. I saw Sidney in the theater, and he gave a magnificent performance. And I think he's just like an English squire, country squire.
I think you could tell us more about the great Douglas Fairbanks than anybody. When did you first meet him?
I met him at Elsie Janice's. Now, you probably don't know her either, but she was a great star in the theater. She was, well, I'd say the most successful theatrical child. And when I was getting $8 a week, she was getting $70 a week. And the Torontonians will probably recall Shays Theater on Young Street.
Oh, yes, yes. You may be sad to know that it's been pulled down.
Well, it won't be pulled down in my memory. I can see it now and can see Elsie. And she was called the sweetheart of the American troops. She went right up to the front to entertain them. Wonderful entertainer, wonderful mimic. And I went out to her house, let's see. It was called Phillips Manor, and they claimed that George Washington stayed there. And that was the first time I met Douglas Fairbanks. I had seen him in the theater in The Gentleman of Leisure.
Mm-hmm.
And to tell you the truth, I wasn't impressed by him.
Why?
Well, maybe it's because I'm Canadian, I don't know. But I thought he was too exuberant.
Well, that was his trademark almost, his abundance of energy and vitality.
You know, I was intolerant and maybe not in a happy mood that day. It was cold, it was November. And he had just come into pictures. He had been a big star in the theater. He was contemporary of Barrymore.
Yes.
Jack. He and Douglas were always together on Broadway in different plays, of course. And that was my first meeting with him. And Elsie and he and Owen Moore started out together. And they said, "You stay here, Mary, and we'll be back." And I said, "Oh, no, you don't." So I went after them. And I had on some beautiful new shoes. It cost me $15. Well, that's like 75 today, you know.
Yeah.
And they were white kid. And Elsie called back. She said, "Don't ruin your lovely shoes. You better go back to the house." Well, I had different ideas. And I started across this creek. I was walking on this log. And I got in the middle of it. And, of course, it was freezing, cold day. And I was frightened to go back or go forward, and Douglas said, "Do you mind?" And he came across the log and picked me up in his arms and put me safely on the other side. I didn't think it was romantic. I just thought it was a polite gesture. It was only after, in years, that I saw that was the beginning.
You did get to like him.
Rather.
Yes.
As the English say. Oh, he was a wonderful person. You would have loved him. He was a little boy always, and he was just in life as he was on the screen. And do you know? He never, never used a net or a wire or what we call a double. Everything that you saw him do on the screen, he did himself.
You mean he was like that around the house?
Oh, yes. He'd have you out there on the lawn or up there. You know, there's a water tower up there. He'd probably, in the next hour, have you up climbing that.
Yes?
Yes.
Did he never run out of energy?
No, never. He was just as he always was, and I'm grateful, you know, that he didn't have a long illness. He went quickly, and I had a cousin who loved him very much, and he said about Douglas, he said no matter how many people were in the room when he left, the room was empty. This was after he died, and he said that he was like an arrow in full flight.
All the time, I suppose.
All the time.
But isn't that very hard on the heart, that superabundance of energy?
Well, I would imagine so. He played as many as 54 holes of golf a day. And then he invented a game called Doug that was between badminton and tennis. The racket was heavier than a tennis racket, than a badminton racket, and the bird was... heavier than the badminton.
I see. Well, what did he die of?
Heart.
Did he realize he had this condition?
No, I think he thought it was indigestion.
Miss Pickford, when did you and Mr. Fairbanks form your own motion picture company?
In 1919.
What was the name of it then?
United Artists.
Oh, it still is.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't Chaplin have something to do with that as well?
Yes, he and D.W. Griffith and Douglas and I formed the company.
It seems to me that in 1919 you made a picture in which they wanted you to appear with bedbugs. I was reading an anecdote in a magazine the other day.
Oh, I think they're mistaken about the bedbugs. I did appear with 12 New York sewer rats. Griffith said that I was so crazy that if he set the house on fire and put me on the roof and he said to me, jump, I would.
You would?
Yeah. I you know, I'm very obedient in some respects. But that rat thing was terrible. You know that the directors are typed just like actors or writers? Some of the directors have no sensitivity where women are concerned. They cannot direct a woman. Lubitsch was one of them. Ernst Lubitsch.
The Lubitsch touch.
Well, he was a frustrated actor himself. And he didn't know how to direct a woman. But Marshall Neilan was the tops, to my way of thinking, and then Griffith. Now, C.B. DeMille couldn't direct a woman.
When did you first meet him?
I met him when I was 13 years of age. He played my brother. There were four children. It was the Warrens of Virginia. And his brother William wrote the play, and David Belasco produced it. And we remained very good friends ever after that. I made two pictures with him, The Little American and Romance of the Redwoods. That was in 1917.
I've been wondering about this. The stars of the silent era seem so remote to us now. What were they like in behavior? Were they more flamboyant and remote than they are today, the stars of this era?
They were more remote, but I wouldn't say more flamboyant.
We get the impression that they all lived in castles.
Oh, no,
and
that
they were
true.
Never seen in person.
That's so. You mean not actual castles?
Well, huge mansions.
No. Mm-mm.
And they lived a sort of a life of in a never-never land.
Well, that may be true. But we certainly didn't advertise what breakfast food we had in the morning and things like that.
Yes, the movie stars today seem to be more business people. They're less colorful, I think. You can meet them and you're not quite as thrilled.
Only because we have tremendous competition today. We had no TV, we had no radio, we didn't have aeroplanes, we didn't have long-distance phone. We didn't have the world at our on our breakfast tray. What's happened yesterday in London, or even this morning in London, it's photographed and we have it on our in our morning paper. Well, that wasn't so in those days. We had the motion picture industry, we had the theater. And what motion pictures did to the legitimate theater, TV now has, in turn, has done it to motion pictures. I, in my short life, comparatively short life, have seen the birth and the death of motion pictures.
You think the motion picture has died?
Mm-hmm.
But why should it?
Because of the competition. You know, you can see the old motion pictures that are just as good as some of them and better than today. And why should people leave their house?
But you can see a picture so much better on a big screen in a comfortable theater than you can on a box in your living room.
Well, that's true, but it's very expensive. We have to face the fact that at one time there were 17,000 theaters. I don't know what the number is today. But it breaks my heart to go by them and see them, bowling alleys and skating rinks. Certainly, the motion picture will always be there. But I believe that when paid TV comes in, and I'm sure that it'll be less expensive than going to the theater, that it'll be the real death knell of motion pictures.
Getting back to the stars of the silent era, is it true that people in those times earned fabulous salaries and that there were no taxes?
Well, that's not true. I paid 50% of my salary in 1917. We went into the war, that is, the Americans did, in April of 1917. And it was retroactive. My $10,000 a week has shrunk to nothing at all compared to, who was it that I heard?
Marlon Brando is supposed to be getting three-quarters of a million or something like
no,
that.
No, I read the other morning that he was going to get $1 million and 10% of the gross.
That couldn't be matched in the old days, could it?
No. It's impossible for people to keep money today, unless, of course, it's capital gain. And that's what you were asking me a little while ago. Well, now the actors have managers, which we didn't have in those days, and investors, and they have to do it because the life of an actor, the average actor, is very short. And, of course, if he's disfigured, if he becomes ill, or if he loses an arm or a leg, or they're like doctors. I maintain that doctors are people that make big money for a short period of time, that should be taken into consideration.
Well, Miss Pickford, when did you stop making motion pictures?
I stopped in 1933.
Why?
Well, you see, I was my own producer. My first independent picture was Daddy Long Legs. Maybe it's my Irish blood, I don't know. I guess English are also rebels. But I didn't... you know, it's very hard for actors. Those that haven't anything to say about the kind of roles they're going to play and the type of picture they want to make, then they die out. The producers, of course, can get another actor, but an actor can't get another career. And so I wanted to make my own pictures, and I did. But it was too hard for me to be a producer and an actress. You see, when everybody else went home, I had to approve of sets, costumes, sign checks. And when my mother was alive, I never attended to any of the business. She passed on in 1928. And I retired 5 years later. Actually, about 4 years later, because it was the beginning of 1933. It was just too much for me. You see, the average actress goes home if she's had an emotional day. If she's wise, she'll just take a cup of soup or broth and go to bed at 6 o'clock. But there I'd be at the studio until 11 at night and back the next morning at 6. And it was just, I just couldn't take it.
Well, let's talk about Mary Pickford of today. What are your activities?
Well, meeting charming people like yourself.
Thank you.
I have a record that I want to make for Columbia University. Well, of course, there's real estate, bonds, securities, and then there's the civic things, and then my charitable work.
I've heard a lot about your charitable work, and I was told I shouldn't mention it to you, but I understand you do quite a lot of that.
Well, I don't think I deserve any credit for that. You see, the world's been wonderful to me. People have been wonderful to me. The least I can do is to try to pay back in a small any way I can. And I love the very young and the very old. In fact, it's awfully hard, you know. I'd like to be a Barbara Hutton or Miss Duke. I'd like to have tremendous wealth that I could, because everyone that comes to you, you know, every charity deserves consideration and moral and financial support. But, of course, I'm relatively the poor little rich girl.
Tell us about this wonderful home you have, Pickfair. When was this built?
Well, I don't know actually what year it was built. It was a shooting lodge at one time. The quails still come here.
Mm-hmm.
And red fox, not so much today, and coyotes. And they used to come way out in the country. There was only one house between us now here, sitting looking out there at the Pacific. Only one house, the Danziger House. This is now the Bel Air Hotel. And there were no roads to the beach. You know, and the sunset didn't exist in those days. And Douglas bought it, I think, in 1919. And then he added, you see, this wide hall here.
Yes.
And this was the door back there that leads into this, to the service quarters. That was the front door.
Yeah.
And then he built on this, rest of the house, the living room and the bedroom, that section upstairs. And then in 1932, before the Olympics, he built the guest house.
Well, how many rooms do you have in Pickfair now?
I think about 38.
That must take rather a large staff to maintain.
Nobody can afford it anymore. We used to have 16. I think we have about 8 now.
How about the grounds? How many acres?
We used to have 13, but when they wouldn't allow us to keep cows and horses anymore, we subdivided the lower part. I think we have about 4 acres.
And they're beautifully kept. You were mentioning some while ago that you might turn Pickfair into a museum.
That's what I hope.
There's a strong possibility of doing that?
Well, if I may, you know, Beverly Hills is very strict.
It is.
And maybe the neighbors wouldn't like it.
Well, if you ever do, it'll be the most sumptuous museum I've ever come across, because it's so beautifully designed, and you have such a wealth of lovely things.
Well, that's
nice. Books and paintings and chinaware. These are paintings on the wall of this room. These are Rodin originals, are they?
They are, yes.
Where did you acquire those?
I got those in New York. It was a student of Rodin, and he had, I think originally, he had something like 40. I was able to get about 28 of them.
What other treasures do you have that are outstanding?
Well, you can see the cabinet there.
Yes, yes.
Rose quartz, jade, Peking glass, and ivory. And then I have some very rare books. And, of course, the furniture. I have in the dining room original Adam chairs. I shouldn't own them because they're so delicate. And when I see some of my guests teetering on them, I nearly faint.
The thing which interested me most about your house is the room downstairs, the Western room. Now, someone was telling me that the bar is from the real Wild West. Is that true?
Well, it came around the Horn in 1849.
1849?
Mm-hmm. The Gold Rush. And it's one solid piece of mahogany. And the story goes that when it was in Placer, California, the judge, if he got thirsty, they'd go down and continue the trial at the bar.
Do you ever use that room for anything other than a showpiece?
Oh, yes, we start parties off there, you know, and people, if they come in and they're feeling very, you know, sort of dressed up,
yeah.
In 10 minutes, you know, everybody is having a happy time. You know, it's a playroom.
Yes, it has relics from the Wild West. I was wondering if Mr. Fairbanks' things were down there. A
yes.
Gun belt and a hat and chaps and
mm-hmm.
a whip and things.
Those are his. Mm-hmm. and the Remingtons.
The original Remington paintings. Mm-hmm. I've been a fan of his for a long time. They're beautiful.
They were originally they were illustrating. I think it was Cosmopolitan Stories. And I, of course, those are going to a museum too. If I'm not able to turn this into a museum, and you know, I want the proceeds to go to the Motion Picture Relief Fund.
Well, I think we should let you go now because we've taken up so much of your time.
No, I am so happy, you know, to meet Canadians, and I hope that you will convey to the Torontonians my fond memories, my affection for them. I'm very, very proud of being a Canadian. And when I've been asked, which country do you prefer? I said, well, I don't know. I said, England is my grandmother. Toronto, Canada, is my mother. And the United States is my husband. So give them my love.
I will do that, and we're very proud of you.